corpses. Brothers and sisters, let's listen to the 20th, 21st and 22nd verses of chapter Naml.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
فتبسم ضاحكا من قولها وقال رب أوزعني أن أشكر نعمتك التي أنعمت علي وعلى والدي وأن أعمل صالحا ترضاه وأدخلني برحمتك في عبادك الصالحين.
So Solomon smiled, amused at her speech, and said, "My Lord, enable me to be grateful for your favor which you have bestowed upon me and upon my parents, and to do righteousness of which you approve. And admit me by your mercy into the ranks of your righteous servants."
وَتَفَقَّدَ الطَّيْرَ فَقَالَ مَا لِيَ لَا أَرَى الْهُدْهُدَ أَمْ كَانَ مِنَ الْغَائِبِينَ.
And he took attendance of the birds and said, "Why do I not see the hoopoe? Or is he among the absent?"
لَأُعَذِّبَنَّهُ عَذَابًا شَدِيدًا أَوْ لَأَذْبَحَنَّهُ أَوْ لَيَأْتِيَنِّي بِسُلْطَانٍ مُبِينٍ.
I will surely punish him with a severe punishment or slaughter him unless he brings me clear authorization.
فَمَكَثَ غَيْرَ بَعِيدٍ فَقَالَ أَحَطْتُ بِمَا لَمْ تُحِطْ بِهِ وَجِئْتُكَ مِنْ سَبَإٍ بِنَبَإٍ يَقِينٍ.
But the hoopoe stayed not long and said, "I have encompassed in knowledge that which you have not encompassed, and I have come to you from Sheba with certain news."
So, in the previous episode, brothers and sisters, we mentioned that Prophet Solomon, first of all, first and foremost, تفقد الطير. At first, he reviewed the birds. فقال ما لي لا أرى الهدهد. He said, "How is it with me that I do not see the hoopoe? أم كان من الغائبين? Or is it that he is of the absentees?" Now, in the very first step, he controlled his army, he controlled his government as hard as he could. Now, this is not enough. Only informing the others that you do not see such and such, and they have to be in their responsibilities, doing their business, this is not enough. لَأُعَذِّبَنَّهُ عَذَابًا شَدِيدًا أَوْ لَأَذْبَحَنَّهُ أَوْ لَيَأْتِيَنِّي بِسُلْطَانٍ مُبِينٍ, the verse says. So, Prophet Solomon said, "Certainly I will chastise him with terrible chastisement, or I will slaughter him, or he brings me with clear reasons for his absence." Now, for the punishment of the hoopoe, some commentators have mentioned a few examples, like including separation of that hoopoe from its fellow, pulling off its feathers or putting it under sunshine, or banishing it from Solomon's court, or putting it in the same cage with the enemy. One point, however, must be noted, and the fact is that reviewing and being kind to inferiors, visiting their works, and asking about their affairs are among the Islamic ethical, social, educational, and administrative principles. And this is what Prophet Solomon did. And then, in order not to judge in its absence, and in the meanwhile, the absence of the hoopoe does not affect the other birds, still less the persons who undertook some sensitive and important jobs, Solomon adds, "Certainly I will chastise him with terrible chastisement." Now, once Abu Hanifa asked Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and said, "Why did Solomon only ask about hoopoe among all birds?" And Imam alayhi salam said, Its reason is for the fact that a hoopoe sees the existence of water inside the earth the same as we see oil in a crystal container. So that's one of the reasons that could be mentioned for why Prophet Solomon only asked about hoopoe. We'll continue our discussion later on.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
So as we said, in order not to judge in its absence, Prophet Solomon adds, certainly I will chastise him with a terrible chastisement, or I will slaughter him, or he brings me a clear reason for his absence. The purpose of the Arabic word sultan here is a kind of reason which causes one's authority and ability to prove one's mind, and the Arabic word mubin is an emphasis on the matter that this faulty one must certainly bring a clear reason for his own fault. And Solomon, ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhi salam, in fact, without judging in its absence, threatened the offender by the necessary chastisement if the fault is proved. He says, لو عذبنه عذابا شديدا أو لأذبحنه. There are only three choices. لو عذبنه عذابا شديدا, either I will chastise him. The second choice is I will slaughter him. And the third choice is he brings me sultan mubin. He brings me clear reason. He brings me plausible excuse for his absence. There are no other options, and I will not even think about the other options. He even considered two stages for his threat, in order that it could be proportional to the kind of the sin, the stage of punishment without execution, and the stage of execution. And this is really interesting. So, Prophet Solomon, ala nabina wa alihi wa alayhi salam, without judging in his absence, threatened the offender by this necessary chastisement. But he said that we will have to wait for the fault, for the sin to be proved. But he showed that he surrendered to proof and logic even in front of a weak bird, and he would never rely on his power and abilities. This is the most important lesson that we can take from this very verse. We are the slaves of justice and reason and true arguments, even before the smallest animals, even before the inferiors, so to speak. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry, in your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry ends when faith begins.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi. He is going to talk about Palestinian resistance and the brutal attack of Israel on Gaza Strip.
I would like to again talk about the current situation, especially on the North American scene, where we see that, you know, the students in the universities and even the high schools are becoming more active and aware of the situation as far as the Palestinians are concerned. See, America goes around the world preaching about human rights and democratic values, but the conflict in Gaza Strip basically has exposed the hypocrisy in a way that we didn't see before. And it's not surprising that you will see the universities have become an arena of dissent against the U.S. government and policies. Four university presidents were questioned about their policies regarding anti-Semitism on their campuses. When it came to the pro-Palestinian protests by the students, although it started there in the early days of the present conflict, but the protests have now escalated to encampments that we see where the students are actually asking their universities to divest from genocide and to stop investing the large school endowments that they have in the companies which are in manufacturing weapons, which are then supporting the Israel's war in Gaza. Many of these encampments started, major of them started in Columbia University in New York, and now has spread around the U.S. from the northeast coast to Texas and California, and students have been arrested at different universities. High schoolers in Seattle actually walked out of the classes in protest of the war. And today, the school officials in New Jersey have warned the high school students against participating in a walkout planned for today. So we see the awareness is there, especially in the younger generations, but it has an impact even on the senior politicians. You know, it was very interesting to see the video released by one of the senior politicians from the Democratic Party. This is where it shows that deep in their heart they know what is haq. But it is all other political issues, economic interest, which are actually preventing them from speaking the truth. And here I'm referring to Senator Bernie Sanders, who was also a presidential candidate for the Democratic Party in the last election. And the way he responds to Netanyahu's claim that any criticism of the Israeli government's policies is anti-Semitic. This is a label used for any kind of, dissent or disagreement with what Israel is doing. And the way Senator Bernie Sanders have come out in his video, very powerful, where he begins by saying, "No, Mr. Netanyahu, it is not anti-Semitic or pro-Hamas to point out that in a letter, in a little over 6 months, your extremist government has killed 34,000 Palestinians and wounded more than 77,000. 70% of whom are women and children. These are his words. And so, you know, they cannot play around that these are the numbers from the Palestinians. And then he goes, using the same, tone and style, that no, this is not anti-Semitic. When we talk about these issues, he talks about destruction of 221,000 housing units, which has basically made a million people homeless, which is half of the Palestinian population in Gaza Strip. He talks about the civilian infrastructure, which has been completely destroyed, healthcare system, where all, you know, basically they have knocked out 26 hospitals and killed more than 400 healthcare workers. He also talks about destroying all universities which were there in Gaza Strip, 12 of them, and 56 school buildings. And of course, you know, talking about blocking the humanitarian aid and creating an environment where malnutrition and famine is becoming more and more, increasing now. And he ends with the words where he says, "Do not insult the intelligence of the American people." It reminds me of the conversation of Prophet Lut with his people, where he ends by saying, "Isn't there anyone, Rashid, and wise among you to understand what I'm saying?" You know, and this is where he's saying, don't insult the intelligence of the American people. I hope he sends this video with, you know, a special courier to President Biden, because he is the one who needs to open his eyes. In the same bill that they got passed this week, on one hand, he's asking for money to feed the Palestinians and those who are in Sudan and other places. And at the same time, he's asking for $9 billion to send offensive military aid to Israel. So on one hand, he's feeding the Palestinians. On the other hand, he's giving weapons to Israel to kill them. And this is where we realize, you know, this is where we will say, isn't there anyone Rashid among them? You know, this level of anti-Semitic, you know, it has been used so many times that the glue has worn off. It's no more sticking. They use it for everything. Any kind of dissent of the policy against the state of Israel, any kind of protest or remark, immediately they say, oh, this is anti-Semitic. And people realize that, you know, this level cannot be used all the time in all the cases. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala open their minds and hearts to the reality and come away from this path of zulm and injustice to people in any part of the world, inshallah.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last. And tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. I saw those rockets and bombs shining in the sky, like drops of rain in the sun's light, taking away everyone dear to my heart, destroying my dreams in a blink of an eye. What happened to our human rights? What happened to the sanctity of life and all those other lies? I know that I'm only a child, but is your conscience still alive?
No matter what they do, they can never hurt. conversation.
Hello, I'm Jim Gibney, and welcome to a special edition of The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs around Ireland. Continuing on from last week's episode, we will discuss the situation in Armagh Women's Prison in the lead-up to the 1980 hunger strike. Three women joined the strike on December the 1st, 1980. They were Mairead Farrell, Margaret Nugent and Mary Doyle. Before I start, I would like to note this year marks the 50th anniversary of the death and hunger strike of Michael Gohan. This year also marks the 48th anniversary of the death on hunger strike of Frank Stagg and 43rd anniversary of the deaths of the hunger strikers that died in 1981. Before I speak to my next guests, let's get a quick overview on this week's topic.
Armagh's Women's Prison was built in the late 18th century and had served as a holding place for Irish Republican prisoners. In 1975, the population of Irish Republican women prisoners reached a record high of 120. Unlike the male prisoners, female Republicans were allowed to wear their own clothing and as such were never forced to go on the blanket in protest of prison uniforms. They did, however, hold their own no-work protest, in protest of the removal of special category status and the corresponding loss of privileges similar to that of the men in Longcash, during which they refused to engage in any of the tasks which were set to them by the wardens. Like all other prison protests, a large aspect of the women's no-wash protest centred on their ability to raise public awareness of the situation and to recruit the public's support in their mission to change and improve prison conditions. On December 1st, 1980, three prisoners, Mary Doyle, Mairead Farrell and Margaret Nugent, joined their fellow male prisoners in Longcash on hunger strike. Their demands were the right not to do prison work, the right to organise educational and recreational facilities, and the right to one weekly visit, parcel and letter, the right to association with other political prisoners, and the restoration of remission as a result of the process. In the years leading up to and during the peace process, many ex-prisoners were centrally involved in the peace negotiations, with some becoming leading members of Sinn Féin.
So, just before I ask Mary about the circumstances leading up to your decision to join the first hunger strike in 1980, there were seven men in the Hates blocks also on the hunger strike at the time. So, what was going through your head during that period of time to make the decision that you made?
Well, we had been forced onto the no-wash in February of that year. I mean, the men had been on it for years, on the no-wash. So all during that summer, there was conversations between both jails, but comms going backwards and forwards with the OCs, and then it was discussed with us. I mean, we were still entitled to our exercise, and so we were able to discuss all this. So the only alternative we seen was the hunger strike route. So we thought about it long and hard. It wasn't something that we took upon lightly. And I obviously had to think of, excuse me, my own circumstances. I had to think of my own family. But I wanted to not that I wanted to do it, I thought I had to do it because I wasn't expecting somebody else to do something that I wasn't prepared to do myself, so therefore I put my name forward. Mm-hmm.
And there was a small number of women in the prison at that time on protest. How many were there?
At that time there was 32 women. I mean, the men had already started, the seven men had started on the 27th of October, so I think that's why there was a big gap then, because there was only with three women then went forward, Mairead, Margaret and myself. That was always a problem as such, with our numbers being so low in Armagh.
Sure. Sheila, you're 22 years of age at this stage. You're in prison 4 years. The first hunger strike of 1980 has ended. And you have made your mind up that you're going to join a second hunger strike, which is being planned to begin in March 1981. And what I would like to do is read from you, read a call that you sent to the Army Council of the IRA, which is in David Burser's book, 10 Men Dead. And I'd like you to talk to us about where your thinking came from with these very stark words. And you write, "I would not be writing this column if I were not prepared to die. I am the person who wrote those columns to the Army Council pushing for a hunger strike. If I cannot stand behind my own words, I had no right to send those columns. I now propose to stand behind them." So what was going on in a 22-year-old head at that stage that produced that very committed and factual kind of view?
Well, where that had come from, and it's like as Mary was saying, we had been through 4 years of protest in the prisons. Within Armagh, there were women who were doing life. There were women who were doing, younger women were doing SOSP, which meant they didn't even have a release date. You had the whole criminalisation that was going on outside. As far as the Brits were concerned, they were trying to make it out that we were nothing but common criminals or that we were gangsters. And through criminalising the prisoners, they were criminalising our community, they were criminalising our struggle. But unfortunately, the situation in Armagh was, as Mary said, there were only 32 women at that time on the protest. And some of them had been, they were victims of the Castlereagh torture process, who had never been members of the IRA, who could never come forward to go on hunger strike. So we had a small number of women who were prepared to do the hunger strike. But, I mean, it's a circumstance where you have to, as I say in that, you have to put yourself in that situation. And there were women who came to me and said that they didn't feel that they could do it. And that's fair enough. That's you know, it's better somebody coming to you and saying, look, I can't do that, rather than go on to a hunger strike and then discover a week or so later that they can't go through with it, because that just weakens your hand. So when we were left in the situation in Armagh where we didn't have any more volunteers for the hunger strike, I thought, my belief was that the way the British or whoever were going to look at it was that it was a weakness that the women weren't following up with the commitment of going on hunger strike, that it left us in a situation where they would then see the women's prison as the weak link. And my attitude to it was that I had written columns to the Army Council on behalf of the women who had come forward for hunger strike. I had written columns along in conjunction with Mairead Farrell, who was the OC before I became the OC. Mairead stood down when she went on the hunger strike. So we had written columns to the Army Council saying that we could, you know, as far as we were concerned, this was the only way forward. This was the only thing that was going to break what was going on in the prisons. So my opinion, I had to stand over my words, and that's where that came from. It's
quite clear, Sheila, from the frame of mind that you were in when you wrote that column. And Mary, that frame of mind that Sheila was in was clearly the frame of mind that you were in when you joined the hunger strike in 1980. But then that had to be fitted into a wider frame of mind that the political prisoners, both in Armagh Women's Prison and in the Hates Blocks, had in defending the struggle against the British government's attempts to criminalise it. So how important was it for the prisoners to take the stance that they took in relation to defending the struggle against the attempts by the British government to criminalise it as a criminal struggle?
Well, we had to fight the movement to start with, because they didn't want the women to take part. The men in the blocks didn't want the women to take part. And this wasn't being a macho thing or anything. They just thought, what way would you put it, that...
I don't know. I suppose in some ways some of them probably thought, and I don't think it was being misogynistic or derogatory, that they nearly looked upon us as their wee sisters.
Yeah.
And it's like a big brother trying to protect his wee sister. They didn't want to hear us about us getting battered or anything like that. And I think that's basically what it was. It was we'll do it, like, so that you don't have to, was their kind of attitude.
Yeah. But it was a fairly major battle, if you like, taking place between the IRA prisoners in Armagh Women's Prison, the H Blocks, and the British government. It was a seminal battle in the struggle between Republicans and the British government, this whole area of the protest in the prison, in the Armagh Women's Prison and in the H Blocks, in relation to political status. Mary, what was it like when you were on the hunger strike itself?
Well, thankfully, the morning that was announced that the three of us were going on hunger strike, they put the three of us together in a double cell, which was good, you know. And we were still on the same wing as the rest of the women. We continued. All we did then was try to inform people. All we did was write. We had a letter campaign going on at the time, and inform them what was happening in the blocks and Armagh. So we were writing out columns, and that continued for hours every day, and just getting smuggled out. I mean, we always tried to make sure there were, because so few women, but there was at least one visit a day. And so comms could come in and out from the movement and from the blocks. So we wanted to know what was going on. Because, I mean, as we know, as the days went on, we heard Sean McKenna was very ill, you know, and that mm-hmm. was a grave concern for us too. But life went on. We kept busy. We started feeling, obviously it was December, it was cold. They did give us extra grey blankets. But, I mean, the women were coming back from visiting saying, such and such left you send cards and, you know, blah, blah. We never got them. We got the hate mail now with the English postmarks.
Mm-hmm.
And screws were being normal screws, snide remarks, you know, and it was comical if it wasn't so serious. That jail food is notorious for being stinking, cold, very, very, not much of it. But all of a sudden then, there was these plates of piping hot food overflowing that was kept in our cells 24/7. So, I mean, when they took the breakfast out at lunchtime, you know, the lunch was there, then that was kept until tea time, and then supper was kept overnight until breakfast. This is the way it continued.
Yeah.
You know, it was so petty that they actually think, you know, our bloods were getting done every day. You know, did they think we were going to steal a chip or something? You know, it was so stupid. But, I mean, thankfully we were on the wing with the rest of the women, and we were still allowed our hours exercise every day.
So yous were all together, Sheila, then, on the one wing. And so yous were in your cells. Were yous locked? What were the circumstances in relation to the three women who were on hunger strike and yourselves? Did yous have contact with them?
Yeah, well, they were initially on the wing with us until, when was it? What week was it?
It's been in the second week.
Into the second week, they moved them over to what they called in the jail a hospital wing, which was just another part of the circle. But up until then, they were on the wing along with us. And with it being the 32, we arranged that one half of the wing had a meeting with, you know, went out and were with the OC, and the other half of the wing, we were still getting our hours exercise because we had our own clothes. Even though the no wash was still going on at this time during the first hunger strikes. So the three women were still getting exercise in the yard along with the rest of us. So we were able to keep an eye on them from there. And, you know, if you were getting out to empty your chamber pots or anything like that, you could have run over. If there were letters, had say somebody had a visit and came in with a letter for Mary, you could go over and smuggle it in through the door, you know, through the spies mm-hmm. on the door and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And that's the way it went up until they moved them over to the hospital wing. And then when they moved them over there, Mairead was insisting that they weren't going to take exercise unless they were brought over to A wing to exercise along with us. So the entire time that they were on the hunger strike, we were still in contact with them. So they would have been brought over for an hour's exercise out in the A-Wing's exercise yard. And if I wasn't out for the exercise at that time, because they did get their bloods, their blood pressure. I think that there was a number. They did their weight, they did their blood pressure, and there was something else that they did. But Maria would have written that down. And then if I wasn't out, she'd have passed it through the spy to me. And then that was smuggled out so that people on the outside could have a monitor of what the condition was.
Last week, in an interview with Tom Hartley and Shana Walsh, we were speaking about the communication system from outside to inside. And I was just wondering, was there much of a communication between the prisons, Armagh Women's Prison, and the H blocks in terms of what was going on in the prisons?
There was massive. There had always been massive communication because, I mean, the POW department in Sevastopol Street in the old centre, that was like a post office. And the way the system was set up, that you could send out a comm in the morning and have a reply in the afternoon. In our case, it would have been a comm one day and the reply the next day, because we wouldn't have had two sets of a visit on the one day. We also had a situation where there were quite a few women in from country areas. They weren't Belfast people. And they were, when they started the system where they give us a second visit a month, they were giving up one of their visits to get a visit from someone from Belfast, especially during the hunger strike period. And it was mostly young men who were involved in the Youth Against H Block Armagh Committee were coming up on visits with comms and taking comms out, because that communication was vital. But even during that time, like if I'd have had a comm for Bobby Sands, it would have come out of Armagh in one day and been in the H blocks that afternoon. And a response from him to me would have been in by the next day. And then letters, personal letters, were all sent through Sevastopol Street to me.
And how important was the communication system, Mary, to your morale?
It was extremely important because, I mean, we weren't getting newspapers. We did have a smuggled radio, but that was only to listen to the news at night. So you weren't getting a terrible lot of information up because you couldn't listen to it when the screws were on the wings. So hearing about the protests and marches and all that was happening all over the world, you know, that was such a boost for us all, you know, that we weren't, I mean, the Brits were trying to, nobody gave a flam on about us, you know, but we were being told the contrary, you know, and it was a great morale booster.
So if the situation, Sheila, is the preparations are proceeding to begin the second hunger strike on the 1st of March 1981. And then the hunger strike gets underway. And what was the feelings like inside the women's prison at that stage, watching what was unfolding in the H blocks? Because obviously you've got your communications with comrades and all of that kind of stuff. So what was the feeling like among the women prisoners? Can you remember?
I have to be honest, it wasn't great. The first hunger strike, the build-up to the first hunger strike, and then as it progressed, obviously there was that hope that something was going to happen, especially when it was coming to that kind of culmination. And when it ended, I actually heard that through the wee smuggled radio. I heard it on Downtown Radio, an announcement at 10:30 that night that Sean McKenna had been moved to the hospital and that the hunger strike was over. And the three women, the same in the hospital wing, and the governor went into them the next day and said it's over, and Mairead said no, it's not, until we get clarification.
Well, can I just add, unknowns to us, Danny Morrison had tried to get into the prison that night to inform us what was going on, and the NIO refused him entry. Right. So wasn't it, we were just left, like...
Danny was barred from the prison after that. Danny wasn't allowed back in again. And then we were hearing on the wee radio that a document had arrived from the British. But because it was like this kind of let's divide and conquer here, Armagh shut down and they wouldn't let anybody in. They wouldn't let any... Like Danny come up again the next day. And I think, I don't know who it was, came to my door and told me that Danny was there looking for a visit, that their visitors had told them and they weren't letting him in. So eventually I got a visit from a priest. He had been a go-between between the prisoners and the British. He'd actually, I think, received the document. And he came in on the visit and explained to me that this document had come and we would get a copy of the document, and the people were parsing the document at the minute. So we kind of nearly ended it on a high, thinking, this, you know, this is it, this is going to be the end of it. And things settled a wee bit for Christmas, because that was the 19th of December when the women came off it. But then by January, it was quite obvious that the Brits, as far as they were concerned, they had broken the hunger strike, and they believed they'd broken the prisoners, and that was it. They were moving on. They moved, as you know, a number of men in the H blocks went off, had showers, went into clean cells, and Emma refused their clothes, and it just set the whole thing back again. So when the second hunger strike started, I would say nobody was in good form. Nobody.
And when the second hunger strike was beginning, the prisoners ended the no-wash protest in the H blocks. Did that happen in Armagh Women's Prison as well?
Yeah.
So things then began, there were a
just
different...
Just to concentrate everything, focus everything on the second hunger strike. But it took them a few days, because even though there were so few women, they couldn't even facilitate us for showers and baths. And
the hot water ran out, and they were giving us dishwashing soap to wash our hairs with. And they were just totally unprepared for it, like, to be honest. But even, you know, even going off a no-wash protest and getting into a clean cell, it wasn't any sense of elation or anything like that, because Bobby had already begun his hunger strike. And, you know, it was a bad time. There's no other way to describe it. Like, it was a bad time.
So during the period, Mary, of the period from the end of the first hunger strike, the beginning of the second hunger strike, and the actual hunger strike itself then, the women in Armagh, what were you doing by way of solidarity work at that stage? Were you still writing the columns out of the prison in support of the prisoners?
We were. We're still trying to inform the world what was going on. There was great communication, well, between the movement and the blocks.
Were any of the women prisoners in touch with any of the hunger strikers during this period in terms of communications between them? Do you recall?
I wrote to Bobby Sands. We were from the same neck of the woods. We went to the same school, Stella Morris. I only knew him to see before we went into the jail, but then we started writing to one another. So we were getting first-hand information, although the last call I think was I got from him was when he finished his diary, which was the 17th of March, when he finished his diary.
Well, the situation in both Armagh Women's Prison, the morale of the prisoners in Armagh Women's Prison and in the H blocks would have been pretty grim, because the hunger strike ends, there's 10 men dead. And within a very short period of time of that, the prisoners in the blocks get their own clothes, start to get out of the prison cells. So what's life like in Armagh Women's Prison for the women prisoners?
Well, the fight still went on, because we went into the workrooms then to direct them. I mean, we were being to make uniforms of all things in the sewing room, and we went in and sewed two legs together and racked the machines, and the screws and arrows were racked, like, to be perfectly truthful. So at the end of it all then, what they did, they let us do what we always wanted to do, was maintain our wings.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what happened.
So as far as the prisoners were concerned, it was a heavy price to pay.
Of course.
For the years of protest in Armagh Women's Prison, the first hunger strike, second hunger strike, the deaths on hunger strike of the 10 prisoners. But there's no question or doubt from, and it's quite obvious from the conversation, that the women played a full part in the struggle for political status, a full part at every stage along the way, from March 1976, when the British government withdrew political status, until it was restored in the later part of 1981. So what, on reflection, looking back on that period, is that how you see it yourselves?
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, you had your options. You could have went in there and got sentenced and went on to the working wings and just kept your head down and did your short sentence and went out. But you have to remember that those women who were in there, even those who had been battered in Three Castlereagh, were a product of what was being inflicted on our communities. And my attitude was, had there not been a conflict in this country, not one of us would have ever seen the inside of a prison. Never. Circumstances created us. Circumstances created even the struggle on the streets. Like even women coming out and doing as much as beating bin lids or facing the British Army or opening their houses as dumps or meeting places. That doesn't come. There's this talk about, you know, the IRA were gangsters and they kept their community under the jackboot and all of this. You can't do that with an entire community. You can't bring thousands of people out onto the streets. I mean, you can't. You just can't do it. So the women that were in there were a product of that. They'd seen it throughout their whole lives. They'd seen it from they were very young. Most of them wouldn't even have been teenagers when this had started. I mean, I wasn't a teenager when it had started. I was back. I hadn't even started secondary school when the first, like, the first attacks on my community in June 1970, and the attitude of the RUC and the rest of them to what was happening to my community. There was nobody there protecting me.
So the women who were in Armagh Women's Prison were active on the outside in the struggle.
Oh, yes.
And then they continued that activism on the inside. And over the last, from looking back on that 50-year period, it's a period that's inspirational. And you're proud to have been part of that period.
Very proud of my background, very proud of it.
I always say, if I'm speaking in anything, and I always say I would never, ever want any young person to go through, not to live the lives that we have lived, not to go through what we went through. It's horrendous what we went through. Some of us came out the other side. Some of us went to the grave. Mm-hmm. Some of the women that we were imprisoned with died young. I mean, the premature deaths among those women is unbelievable. So people were still, and people are still paying the consequences of the situation in the prisons and on the streets. And I would never, ever want that to happen again. But I have to say, to be honest, I think if it did happen again, I'd have the same attitude. Because there's only one way that you can react to what is being done to you. And that's basically what we did.
Sheila, Mary, thank you very much for taking part in today's discussion. Thank you very much for recalling a period in your lives over 40 years ago when you were active young women in the struggle on the outside and on the inside. And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across our social media platforms. And once again, I'd like to thank our special guest, Mary Doyle and Sheila Dara. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Jim Gibney. Slán an Uisce. Bye for now.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali and Sayyid Abdullah Musaib. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So this series of the program Viewpoints is mainly concerned with an analysis on the important points addressed by the leader of the Muslim Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. In this new series, we are concerned with the topic humans or human beings in the speeches of the leader of Islamic Republic of Iran. That's all right. For today's discussion, I have two guest speakers in the studio joining me. Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Abdullah Musaib. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, we are talking about this a kind of system which is valued by Islam, and that is the religious cum popular governance. We do not prefer the term religious or Islamic democracy,
because I would say democracy has roots in the Western secular system, so it's not good at all to bring this concept to the Islamic terminology and then mix them together and say, okay, we believe in. Because, you know, some of the scholars and ulama inside the religion of Islam has said, we have answers for some of the needs of the human beings compared to what the Western world, the Western philosophy had did to its people. So maybe they coined this term as democracy dini, or religious democracy, in order to say that democracy is in the very nature of Islam itself and has answer for the needs of the people. But, you know, when we talk about this popular governance, you know, or the governance by the people, over the people, and also having roots in the divinity, the position of the people comes into the scene, the importance of the position of the people. What do you mean exactly, Sayyid Abdullah, when we say that the position of the people is valued in a society or in Islam?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Now, beginning from the verse of the Quran, وَلَقَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي Adam, that we have honored the son of man, or the son of Adam. Now Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, obviously, when he created his humans and he created the human beings, he wanted them to live a certain lifestyle and to abide by certain rules and certain regulation.
Yes.
These rules and these regulations obviously passed on by the prophets and maintained and guarded by the imams, by the divine appointed leaders by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So when we look at each other as people, our rights are set, right? I know my rights, you know your rights.
Yes.
Now, the problem is, as human beings in our kind of lifestyle, that if we left to ourselves, we usually break these laws.
Yes.
We do not abide by them.
Yes.
So from here, Islam came and said, okay, you need to have a system of government where there has to be a head and there has to be a body. And
yes,
the head would tell the body where to go.
Yes.
And then everything would go very well. So in the absence of an infallible, so now we need to have a leadership.
Yes.
Right. Now, the mistake that we make sometimes, we, as people, we want to lead or we want to live in a system as if it is governed by an infallible, mm-hmm, which is not going to happen. It's impossible.
Okay.
Right? Because unless you have an infallible imam, then everything goes smoothly. If there's no infallible imam, then things will not go smoothly.
Does it go smoothly? Because at the time of the infallibles, it did not go well.
No, because that's another topic for another day. Because did the infallibles lead? Did they establish a system or not?
At least at the time of Imam Ali for 5 years.
Even Imam Ali alayhi salam,
yeah,
he done what he could.
Okay.
But did he acclaim? Did the Prophet acclaim, yes, that they established a system?
Okay.
They didn't.
Uh-huh. You mean
the
officially
only system
to claim,
that even, okay, Allah had promised is the time of the Imam.
Yes.
Ala dinu kulli, when,
yes,
the time to Allah to reveal Islam to be the major religion,
yes,
with the head. So the only, mm-hmm, religion, that Islamic religion, that will be established is at the time of the Imam alayhi salam,
mm-hmm,
Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Yes.
All the other Imams and even the Prophet himself, they never acclaimed that they've established a government.
Okay.
Now, even Imam Rabah alayhi salam, when he was offered,
yes,
he rejected because he said it's not time for it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, so as people, we said, okay, sure, we don't have an imam, but we still need to maintain our affairs. We need,
yes,
to have a system that governs us.
That's right.
Now, so people came up with their own theories.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some had elections, and they started this kind of
yes,
way. Some people went with, tyrannic,
yes,
rulership,
yes,
where people is heresy, like,
yes,
parents and lead, and,
yes,
like the Abbasi dynasty, the Umayyad dynasty, the,
yes,
Uthmani dynasty, and now that we have the Saudi dynasty, and we have all other dynasties.
Yes.
So father passes on to son.
That's all right.
Where these people take the rights of the people.
Mm-hmm.
Other people which assume they have this kind of option to choose, that delusion of choosing, I should say it, they also try to create a system, a government.
Yes.
That's trying to control them and maintain them. Now, this is what we have currently. We have these two systems. Now, whether people get their rights, mm-hmm, or not,
yes,
that's a discussion.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, but before Islam, we had these Persian Roman empires all around the world with their own governing system. When Islam comes to the scene as a religion in order to correct some of the ideas in the Persian Roman Empire, but unfortunately after the demise of the Prophet, I think the system of the caliphate and ruling over the countries, all the other lands, you know, becomes very much like the Persian Empire ones.
Well, that's the
thing. I mean, the system of the governance.
See, that's the thing is, like,
yeah,
I said, human beings were programmed,
mm-hmm,
to live in their system.
Yes.
That's how Allah made them. Okay. That's why if you go back to history, if you go, whether you go to the Romans, the Babylonians, you go to whatever civilization you go to,
the Persians,
they had a system.
Yes.
Right? They always had a system because as human beings, we programmed to live under a system.
Yes.
We can't, Allah did not program us to live just like that everywhere.
Okay.
So we naturally want to have a system or create a system of, our own. Now, whether the system abides by the laws of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, oh no, that's a different story.
Yeah.
Now, the Christians before us, they had the church was governing everything. It was the governing body.
Yes.
But when the king, his own interests collided with the religion, with the church, he separated the church from politics.
That's all right.
And he's like, okay, now, politics is one thing, religion is another. You guys take a seat.
Okay.
When we came to Islam, Islam obviously brought that perfect system for people to live in harmony. But people themselves, obviously, after the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, they did not abide by the rule. Mm-hmm. They outcasted the rightful leader of humanity.
That's
and right. Islam became a matter of divide and conquer.
Yes.
So all the khalifs who came,
yes,
their mission, their aim, their job was to expand the land and create wealth.
Yes.
That's why they went all the way to Spain and all the way
to
China.
Yeah.
And it wasn't anything about the system itself. It wasn't anything about people or the right of the people. It was just about divide and conquer, making more land. So the point I was just trying to make before the Hajj speaks, that human beings... It's in our system to have a system or to live in a system.
Even in our fitrah and nature to be ruled.
Yeah.
By.
Exactly. Yeah. That's how Allah made it.
So, so this being ruled by, you know, by government or by the very kind of the people around, you know, it makes lots of difference, isn't it? Because at least there has to be a government.
Okay. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad and his purified progeny. Say it was true. Allah programmed human being from the very beginning, from the time that He actually sent Adam to the earth. Mm-hmm. Look, Allah never ever leaves human beings without a proof on the earth, a hujjah. So He completes the proof of Himself on the scene of the earth. Look, when He sends Adam, He gives him a program. This is the program that which is working for your society. Next comes to Nuh, then to Hud and Salih and other prophets. So in no time in the history you can find that there was no prophet of God on that time on the scene of the earth.
Okay.
So Allah give us. So theoretically, basics and fundamentals of a system has been already there. So to what extent, look, the prophets actually implemented these rules and these regulations. This is due to, actually, this can find itself in the company of the people with the prophets.
Mm-hmm.
For example, at the time of the prophet Nuh, for 1,000 years he preached, but only 100 or 110 people actually joined him. So this is not the problem with the Nuh. The same goes for the Imams of Ahlul Bayt. So it said that Imam Ali never claimed that he actually made a fully Islamic government.
Okay.
But he actually knew the fundamentals. He made, theoretically, he actually built it. And
sorry, Brother Ali, a problem might come up over here that the system of the values, I mean in terms of the religion of faith, is intact and immaculate, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is for sure. But the case is that if this immaculate system cannot be practiced at all by its true practitioners,
so
what would happen?
Again,
and sorry... And sorry, this is when the Nietzsche, you know, this German philosopher has come to the scene and said that that's why God is dead. Because the value system that the church introduced could not answer the needs of the people, so God is dead. So now there is need for another system of the needs. So here comes democracy to the scene, this secularism to the scene, and somehow answering the needs of the contemporary human beings.
If we're talking from an Islamic perspective, I answer you by a Quranic verse. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "Inna hadaynahu as-sabil, imma shakaran imma kafura." Look, I have given you the way. I have showed you what the way is, what the system is. If you, out of your freedom, do not join it, do not actually obey it. So this is not the problem with the prophet who actually was preaching this and with the system which has been absolutely working well. But this is due to the freedom of the people that they did not select this one and selected the other one, the opposite one. So Allah gave us the